Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth. And the question I have for you is, do you feel alone out there? Well, I want to set the stage for our guest in this wonderful book that he wrote. I just want to talk about one experience I had over 20 years ago, maybe 25 years ago, when someone was muscle testing my arm for strength or weakness. And when it was strong, it meant my arm was in agreement to what she was asking it. And she started to ask it all these questions silently about my life, and she was taking notes and not telling me anything. And my arm was just strong or weak, who knew? It just did its own thing. And when she got done, she read her notes and she told me all about my life. And I said, oh my gosh, I have a really smart arm, a smart shoulder. Wow, that's cool. And then I realized all of a sudden, holy smokes, it's not my arm. It's something beyond. She went beyond my mind. She went to a place higher than me, outside of me, inside of me, somewhere else to get this. And when that happened, I said to myself, I'll never be alone again. I knew that I was connected to a greater consciousness. And it was extremely empowering, probably one of the most empowering things that ever happened to me. And as many of you know, I've been a practicing intuitive ever since. And I don't talk to my arm. Actually, I have direct access. So with that groundwork, I want to talk about our one mind. Where we come from, one mind. Where we think, one mind. Who are we, one mind? And to help us know that better is the author of a book called One Mind. And he's been on the show before. Wonderful man who I've talked with and really enjoyed talking with is Larry Dossey. Larry, welcome.
Peter, it's great to be back with you.
I'm so glad because I love this book. I love what you're doing in the world. As a doctor, as a scientist who's helping us know what kind of science is wise science and where should we look for evidence of what's true for us and where do we get stuck? And you see, this book really examines a lot of the stuckness out there and how people just aren't open to one mind.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think stuck is a good way to talk about it, because the fact is that for all of the 20th century, we have sort of been mesmerized to think that the basic fact of our existence is one of isolation and separation, and I think that just simply doesn't fit with the facts. If we look at how we now know consciousness behaves, we can say, I think firmly, that it just doesn't have any rigid boundaries. You can't put it in a box and wall it off from all the other consciousnesses out there, and in some way consciousness simply comes together. The term I use for this, Peter, is non-local, which is a term borrowed from some advances in physics to describe a situation where things, no matter how far apart and how obviously separate they are, in some deep sense, come together in unity. This is an idea that has been applied to subatomic particles, but now we know that it is one of the best descriptors we have out there for how our very minds behave. So this is really the basis for this notion of one mind.
Right, and we need an open mind to know the one mind. I've been emailing with someone who I grew up with, who's an esteemed professor at one of the larger, more renowned universities, and he insists that everything is strictly based on metabolism and the brain, and there's nothing beyond that, and we are living in a parascience that has no respect from the scientific community.
You know, that's just simply, with all due respect, not true. There are many surveys that have been done sort of on the sly, and the participants in them were anonymous, looking at the belief systems of various sorts of academics in the nation's colleges and universities. And at least 50% of the academics out there, and even the hard sciences, believe that so-called ESP, or extrasensory perception, has already been proved, or is likely to be proved. You know, what we hear in the media are the skeptics and critics who chant the same mantra year after year, that there is no proof, this is all woo and California nonsense and so on. This just doesn't keep up with the trends in research in this field, or even the opinions of hardcore scientists, which are increasingly open to this idea of the connectedness of consciousness across space. And in the book, I talk about some of the great scientists in the 20th century who came down firmly and for this idea of the one mind, including the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Erwin Schrödinger and the eminent physicist David Bohm, who said explicitly, at some level of consciousness, there is only one mind.
That's wonderful to know, because many of us live in that one mind. Let's talk about how people are experiencing this in their lives. They might not be aware of it in the way that we're talking about it.
Well, you know, the basic idea is that we can share thoughts and feelings, cognitions and so on between one another in a way in which space doesn't matter, or even time doesn't matter. Since time immemorial, people have described individual experiences, you know, so-called anecdotes, and just people's stories about sharing thoughts and feelings at a distance. But the thing, Peter, that has revitalized this conversation in the past few decades is just hardcore research. Just one example, there are hundreds of studies now that have been done at Princeton and elsewhere around the world in a field called remote viewing, in which people, even when they're separated at global distances on the other side of the earth from one another, in these control studies, they can exchange information almost in camera-like detail sometimes. And this is, I think, overwhelming evidence that information can be operate outside the brain, irrespective of space and time.
Well, there are quite a number of intuitives. Remote viewing is one way to be an intuitive. I work with what I call clairaudience, and I hear information. And I work with people every day who I tell things to that I'm hearing, and they say, it's impossible for you to know that. No one knows that but me, or, you know, me and my closest friend or my parent or whatever. And how did you know that? How could you have known that? Uh-huh. And I remember an attorney that I had worked with one time. He, the person who sent him in to see me, he was sure that I had followed him for a month with a private investigator. So,
well, I hear these kinds of stories all the time. I've got a file cabinet full of testimonies from people who have bumped into people like you, Peter, who have no business knowing about the details of their life, but yet when they're told about these things, for some people, they don't rebel like this guy did you're talking about, but they can literally be opened up and almost transformed by a greater, more expansive sense of who they are and how their mind behaves. So
I've said that to myself for about the last 20 years, that one of my prime purposes is to basically shock people into knowing that there's more in reality than they understood before this.
That's a nice form of shock therapy. I really like that, Peter.
Good. Well, you and I have a long history of entanglement with our brothers.
That's exactly right.
Yes, and we are both identical twins. And we have had very, very strong entanglement experiences with our twin who we can't seem to. When I was young, I just couldn't get out of his way. Wherever I went, he was already there. Whatever I wanted to wear, he was already wearing it. You know, we have had a life like that. we'll show up and haven't seen each other in a few months, and we'll be wearing the same clothes.
Well, that's part of the my twin brother and I just call that twin stuff. You know, it's so common that it's just part of our life. We don't even remark about it much anymore. It's just the way things work.
Well, we had to get away from each other for a while. We went to separate colleges because we needed our own space.
Well, that's very interesting you bring that up, because my brother and I, my identical twin brother, I had the same experience. We graduated at the top of our class in university, and even before that, high school, and we went to medical school together, but my brother had the good sense to realize that he didn't want to compete with me for the rest of our life, and he transferred laterally to dental school after 6 weeks of medical school, and just to try to develop his own sense of personhood and individuality, and I think it was a very wise move on his part. So a lot of identicals don't particularly enjoy that closeness and seem to need to develop their own personal space, which was the case with my identical twin brother.
Right, and yet the interest in each other, love for each other, doesn't stop. It's just more appreciated when we can have our own space as well.
Oh, I could not agree more. Exactly.
Yeah. So there's so much out there that, I mean, twins are one example, twins who were separated at birth and they come together, and you talk about a number of situations in your book where twins who never knew each other are living almost identical lives, and uncanny.
Well, it is uncanny. A lot of this information comes out of something called the Minnesota Twin Study, which has been going on for decades now, in which they studied identical twins who were separated at birth, and then when they're brought together years later, as you say, it is uncanny about how their lives seem to have been duplications of each other, to the extent of, for example, marrying women whose names were the same, of having pets that they named the same, and having children that they gave the same names to. There isn't any easy way to get that sort of thing out of genetics. Genes code for proteins, and there isn't any known way that you could attribute all of these correlated facts.
Genes aren't going to give you names.
not as far as we know.
Right.
But, you know, the skeptics love this study because they say it proves that it's all genes, and which I think that's fantasy. There's no way that that could be true as far as I'm concerned.
Right. And so there are so many other kinds of experiences that people have. You don't have to be a twin to experience the one mind. There's also so many, for instance, I'm thinking of children who were born from other lifetimes and actually start talking about stories of these other lifetimes. And the research has shown that those lifetimes existed in the detail with the names and the family members and the locations that these children know about. And there's no reason that little children should know that much.
And there are thousands of cases that have been investigated by people like Dr. Ian Stevenson and Dr. Jim Tucker at the University of Virginia and countries around the world. You know, this business of reincarnation and past lives used to be considered absolute fantasy, but this is an area of serious investigation that even diehard skeptics are becoming increasingly open to, I find, in reading their opinions about this particular area of research.
Right. I mean, there's so many different experiences that people have that science doesn't know what to do with. For instance, near-death experiences that hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people have had.
Well, that's exactly right. And one thing I think that is quite interesting about these shared feelings and thoughts and sensations and so on between distant people is that they often serve what we call a survival function. because they're related to someone out there who's in distress, who may be headed for an accident or some sort of tragedy. And then the person who gets this mentally or psychologically or however, intervenes in that person and really often saves their life. This idea that these connections between people help one survive is interesting, because biologists say that if there's any kind of trait or quality that people have which functions to help them survive, then that may well be coded genetically into their genes and survive in the sense of being passed on to succeeding generations, so that by now this survival function of knowing things at a distance and sharing thoughts and feelings might be very widespread in the human population, which I think it is. I think most people probably to some degree have this ability to participate in a one mind, shared mind way, because it does help people survive.
And especially with those we're entangled with through love.
Exactly. Yes, that's a great thing to bring out, because most of these shared thoughts and feelings do occur between people who are emotionally close. The classic situation is a mother and her child. The mother just knows that the child is out there about to fall into the swimming pool, the old classic story, and rushes out to save the child just in time. But these examples also occur in other emotionally close relationships, such as between lovers, between identical twins, which you and I have already mentioned, and between spouses and non-twin siblings.
Right.
So love and emotional connectedness seems to be sort of a glue, if you will, that helps thoughts come together between distant people.
And you wrote a whole book about premonitions,
mm-hmm.
and I interviewed you for that two, 3 years ago, and it's wonderful to experience that. I had a dream recently; it was kind of a nightmare. And it came true a few hours later, and it was an amazing premonition of some bad news I was going to hear. But I heard it first in my dream,
uh-huh.
and then somebody in the same location that the dream was in came to tell me something that was difficult to hear, and you know, unhappy, but it resolved itself. So I'm glad that happened, but my brain, my unconscious brain, my one mind came through and gave me a preview of that experience.
That's fascinating. You know, I was shocked really by premonitions in dreams, so-called precognitive dreams. During my first year of medical practice as an internal medicine physician, I one night had a vivid dream that I thought at the time was one of the most vivid dreams I'd ever had in my life. And it was a complex dream involving the young son of one of my medical colleagues. And long story short, this dream got played out in camera-like detail the next day. And I was unnerved by that, because at that time in my life, I knew that the world just did not work like that. You couldn't know something before it happened. But there it was. And that was one of my first encounters with this. And I must say, if something happens like that to you personally, there's no going back through the eye of the needle.
Right.
After you've passed,
you know it. You already know it.
You know it. Yes, exactly right.
Right. And so many experiences we have show us this one mind. One thing you talk about in your book is the sense of being stared at.
That's exactly right. This comes out of what is turning into a lengthy line of research by people around the world, including Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, who's a biologist in England, and others, in which they test this common experience of knowing that someone's looking at you in a restaurant, you turn around and look at somebody straight in the eye, or at a stop sign, you look over at the driver in the next car who's staring at you. And it's a common experience, but they have used closed-circuit television to test someone's awareness of when they're being stared at. And it really is quite fascinating. This is so replicable that you can't explain it by saying, well, this just happened according to chance. And I think this is a pretty solid idea that we do communicate mentally at a distance, and that this is much more common than we think.
Well, there's so many ways that we pick up and get into a one mind, and you talk about, in your book, you talk about groupthink.
Well, that's right, and I think that this one mind phenomenon can disseminate in groups, and it's not always a nice thing, because when people get on the same wavelength in a group, they often stop being creative, they lose their natural-born healthy skepticism, and they can all just sort of go along in order to get along. And there are several instances in American political history where that seems to have been the case, as I talk about in the book. One example being the Bay of Pigs invasion during President John Kennedy's first year in office, which was a disaster, in which everybody on his team just sort of went along with this idea, which was crazy and proved to be a huge mistake.
And also planetarily, there was an incredible one mind after 9/11.
Oh, yes, that's a good one to bring out. It's one that's still fresh in our memory.
Right, and how we all felt at one. We had a common enemy and common grief, and we didn't necessarily know who the enemy is. I don't know that we really do yet, but we certainly know what our grief is and shared it with an incredible heart of oneness.
Well, I'll never forget that. I mean, it was almost an altered state of consciousness, because almost overnight Americans put their divisions and disagreements, political differences aside, and all came together in a profound, almost palpable sense of oneness.
Yeah, that was beautiful. But now I want to ask you, this might be a little too complicated, we probably only have a few minutes left, but people are thinking maybe that the one mind might just be a way to lose a sense of self.
Uh-huh.
And you talk about it not being an infinite blob. We sure are individuals in that one mind. And I think maybe David Bohm expresses it pretty well. Can you talk about it?
Well, one of the complaints I hear all the time is that I don't want to hook into this one mind thing because I'll lose my personality and my sense of self. And I'll just be sucked into some sort of homogeneous goo where I can't tell myself from anyone else. That is a kind of a rational complaint until you experience this. And for most everyone who has this experience of being at one with other people, it just doesn't behave like that. People tend to retain their individuality and their personality, and if anything, are made more unique and significant. This is what scientists have called a true complementarity, in which things that appear to be opposite and mutually exclusive are in fact are necessary to attain a better description of something. And so it's not an either-or sort of thing. It's not that you're an individual or you're part of the one mind. It's a both-and. And so in practice and in experience, I think people can just toss this worry out the window, because it just doesn't prove true in terms of people's actual experience.
Right. That one mind might be the composite of all truth and all data that we can actually draw from and live
good
in.
Good way to put it, yes.
Thank you. Well, and actually that talks about the cosmic soup that we can draw from, that you talk about in your book, related to artists and scientists and And it's amazing. I have a friend who does automatic writing. Uh-huh. She's kind of in a trance, and her hand just keeps scribbling on paper, and she doesn't know what she's writing. And when she gets done, it's this magnificent poetry.
You know, I talk about some examples like that throughout American literary history. One was the poet Yeats. He and his wife, she engaged in automatic writing and gave him a set of metaphors, which he said transformed his poetry over the course of many, many years. So I think that one mind can put us in contact with sources of information outside of what our own brains can come up with. One example I talk about in the book is Thomas Edison, the great American inventor, who his own record for saying, I've never invented anything. The first time I read that, I just thought that was a real jaw-dropper. I mean, here's one of the greatest inventors in world history claiming never to have invented anything. And he went on to say that ideas come to me from the universe. He said, I get information from the outside. And this was a very clear, description that it's possible to look outside of our own individual minds for information that can really be transformative.
Right, and that's what I have to do as an intuitive. I sit with people, and I just have to blank my mind. I can't think about anything. I can't try to be deductive. I can't reason nothing. I just have to hear and express what I hear. And it's an incredibly innocent way of living. It makes life a lot easier, too. You don't have to think for yourself.
Yeah, it takes the pressure off.
It does. It's amazing. I have no pressure because I know that I'm going to hear what I need to hear.
Well, that's beautifully stated. You know, one thing I want to bring out is the implications, the larger implications of this idea that we're all connected and that there are not any boundaries to our minds. You know, you can be bounded in space or in time. And if our minds are not bounded with respect to time, that means that there are no limits in time to our minds. And if that's so, this opens the door for the idea of immortality, which is a sense of being timeless, of going yet beyond any constrictions in time.
It's an extremely powerful idea that you have.
Well, I think it's a very freeing idea because most people live with a dread of the annihilation of everything they are with physical death. But this idea of the one mind opens up a new vista, which says that if, as the evidence suggests, there are no boundaries in time to our minds, and they're eternal and they're immortal. So we get a lot of assurance, I think, in mental peace from this idea of the one mind, if we're willing to look to some of the majestic implications of the basic idea.
This is so great to end the show on this. So Larry Dossey, Dossey. Most people have heard of your name before because you've written many books and are very well known. And I'm so honored to have you on the show talking about your new book, One Mind. And it's so fabulous to have read it. I really enjoy talking with you. Hope we can get you back on the show again at some point
soon. It would be a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Larry.
Thanks, Peter.
And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. Lots of online classes, all kinds of things happening. I'd love to hear from you, and thank you so much for listening.